Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, new surveys from Bank of America and AAA reveal hundreds of thousands of people in Central Ohio have a summer trip planned. Jay Fox will have more on that with an expert, and he'll have a conversation about public transportation for renters in Columbus. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective,
AAA predicts hundreds of thousands of people right here in Central Ohio have plans for a summer trip sometime this summer. New data from Bank of America reveals that travelers are getting savvy about saving, with many travelers opting for road trips and lesser-known, more budget-friendly destinations. Laura Monfred is the head of consumer credit card products at Bank of America and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning.
Laura, what are the key trends for travel spending looking like so far for this summer?
Yeah, I think, despite growing concerns around the economy, a recent Bank of America survey showed that 74% of Americans are planning to travel this summer, and that's up 2% from last year. Domestic travel remains the top choice in 25, with 70% of Americans planning trips within the U.S., and that's up 3% versus last year. So people are still planning to get out there and travel.
Now, while they're traveling, are they planning to go to a theme park, see a concert? What about entertainment spending?
Yes, entertainment is key. So whether it's a concert, a sporting event, a festival, Americans are making entertainment a priority. What we're seeing is that a third of people plan to attend more of these types of events than they did last year. And in fact, many are willing to travel to seek out these experiences. And that might mean traveling outside their home state or even internationally to go do these types of events. It's definitely a priority that people are looking forward to doing this summer.
Now, of course, this is a time where we're all looking at our bank balance, our credit card statements, and our wallets and saying, can we really afford to do this? What are the consumers telling Bank of America about adapting their travel plans to be more budget conscious this summer?
What we're hearing and seeing more of is that travelers are planning to just hit the road. Road trips are going to dominate. 63% are choosing to drive. And so that means airfares, we are seeing it come down, but we would expect to see more crowded highways, national parks, the scenic routes are definitely going to be in more high demand. And as you mentioned, on entertainment, that's also central to people's plans. So whether they're going to different sporting events or concerts, I know later this month, the FIFA World Cup is kicking off. So we're expecting to see a boost in tourism in some of those larger cities that are hosting these events. But the other thing that people are doing to save money on these trips are, what we're calling, they're seeking out destination dupes as another way to save.
Well, I'm going to bite. What is a destination dupe?
Destination dupe is a lesser-known, more budget-friendly destination. So think about an alternative to hotspots where you're not sacrificing the travel experience. Maybe it's going to parts of Montana instead of Iceland, or the Philippines instead of the Maldives. What people are looking for is budget is part of it, but they also just want more relaxed experiences. I went to Europe last summer, and it was wonderful, but it was really, really crowded. And sometimes you come back from those vacations feeling like you need to rest up again. So what we're seeing is that a lot of travelers, over 92% of them, are open to looking for more of these hidden gems to save on money, but also just to have a more relaxed and authentic vacation. It also helps them stretch their budget. So if they're going to one of these locations that are less expensive, it might mean they can stay longer. Who does not want a longer vacation? Or maybe they can stay at a nicer accommodation that they couldn't have afforded in another city. So people are looking for value without sacrificing the experience.
What about folks planning to take what we call a staycation, like when they stay at a hotel or an Airbnb in their home community, rather than, driving or flying a distance? Has anybody talked about that?
Yeah, people are doing that as well. We're seeing about 25% of people planning to stay just within their home state, but just trying to get out of their everyday routine and spend some time with friends and family. So there are, people who are looking to just stay more local and, again, just find opportunities to save money but also relax.
I remember when I was a kid growing up in another century, we didn't have a pool, so occasionally, my parents would rent a hotel room at a place where there was an outdoor pool. and that was our summer vacation.
Those opportunities are always memorable, right? You see, you still remember it. So I think just it's about finding those opportunities to do what fits within your budget, which is important. People should think about being honest with themselves, what their budget is, and how to create experiences and vacations that can create those memories, but doing it without overextending themselves.
You know, when you go on a trip, there are all kinds of hidden costs. Obviously, it costs money to travel, whether you drive or you fly. Mm-hmm. But then you've got to take into account food and beverage, and we've already talked about entertainment, but what we didn't talk about was souvenirs. What did the survey say about all of these hidden costs and how folks can have a more rewarding summer for their money, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit on it, that summer is full of a lot of opportunities to overspend. And the key thing is really to be honest with yourself about what your budget is, because what you don't want to happen is you just go and book a hotel or airfare, and then suddenly, to your point, you have no money for souvenirs or the excursions, or you're stressed about going out to dinner. So what we recommend is reverse budgeting. Be honest with yourself. Think about maybe what you spent last summer and create a budget. And we can just pretend, let's call it $1,500. Now you know how much you have to spend. Give yourself a cushion for unexpected expenses. And then think about destinations, hotels that all fit within your budget while giving yourself a cushion to enjoy things like going out to dinner or souvenirs and not being stressed about overspending. And think about what's non-negotiable. Do you have to go to that concert this summer? Then maybe you got to give up that outfit you've been eyeing. So really just thinking about what's critical to you and creating the right budget is important to do that up front.
A lot of folks are going to say, how do we even start by creating a budget? Do we look at 1 week's pay? Do we look at a month's salary? What is a good percentage of our income that we should allocate to a trip like this?
Really depends on the individual, and what you need to do is make sure that you have savings for unexpected circumstances. And so what we recommend is anywhere from 3 months to a year of savings put aside for unexpected situations that could occur. So once you do that, and maybe that's hard for people, so you need to think about what's the right number for you and what are you willing to give up on, right? Sometimes you have to cut back on some of the non-essentials so that you feel like you're creating that cushion that you need to, and then carving out a percentage of that to plan your vacation and what you're comfortable with being able to also manage your savings.
All of these are great trips. If we want to learn more, and see, that was a Freudian slip. They're great tips about great trips. There we go. If we want to learn more, what's a good website for us to visit?
So for more savings tips, I recommend visiting bettermoneyhabits.bankofamerica.com.
All right. We want to thank Laura Monfred from Bank of America for joining us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Columbus is a car town. Nearly 93% of all work commuters drive to work. A new point-to-point study shows that renters who switch to public transportation instead of driving could save over $5,600 a year. Doug Ressler is the business intelligence manager at Yardi Matrix, and he joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Thank you. The biggest issue that a commuter in Columbus faces is travel time to and from work. How much faster is a car rather than public transportation, according to your findings?
Well, right now, you know, it takes about 30 minutes each way for a car. And what we have found is that commuting, especially in the Columbus area, needs a little bit longer, just under 50 minutes. And so what that constitutes is the fact that people will choose independently to drive as opposed to public transportation. One of the things that we've seen is that as cities grow and leads to urban sprawl, they can result in longer commutes for living in the suburbs. And even though Columbus is not a dense city like New York, it is experiencing that type of limited public transit options.
Is the cost savings that we mentioned, that $5,600 a year, is that enough to convince people to change their modality?
Well, you know, it's interesting. That's a great question. I would hearken back to to a 1990 study by an Italian physicist. His name is Marchetti. It's called Marchetti's Constant. And in his observations, and he went through it and he looked at it over time on numerous cities, and what he found was that it explains the way ancient and newer cities alike have developed through time. And whenever a new technology arrives that zips people to work faster and faster speeds, towns typically grow outward, but not so far that commutes exceed 1 hour per day, both ways included. And so that seems to be holding true, that human behavior, regardless of the cost, is really more about time and the flexibility of time, so that if something takes longer, I could tell you right now, you know, I could save you $10,000 a year as an example, but in reality, it would take you an hour and a half to do that commute. You'd probably say thank you very much and leave.
Did the study only focus on renters, or were homeowners impacted as well?
It really took into account, or Point Homes folks took into account the 30 most populous cities by census, and it did not look at renters or homeowners. It lumped everybody together, and it was sourced from the U.S. Census American Survey. The data on fuel and maintenance costs was sourced from AAA and Bankrate. And the financial cost of public transportation was sourced from APTA, which is a local transit authority website. And then we use median income for renters and households at the national level for all those cities.
Now, here's the million-dollar question, and it's one that has been debated for at least 60 years. How does a community overcome the perception that public transit is beneath them?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that we have found, and that's a very good question, and it's a lot of unpacking. Behavioral economic folks have been looking at that for quite some time. And one of the things that we have found in surveys is one of security and safety. Even though people don't check it on the box, public transportation is sometimes viewed as not being secure or not being safe or being inconvenient. And I think those are the type of things that need to be addressed by local governance and business to be able to take the public into a point where they begin using public transportation.
I mean, you saw that in cities like New York, where everybody takes the subway and they're comfortable with the subway, even though there have been safety concerns over the years, especially in the 70s and the 80s. But in a city like Columbus, how does a community overcome the increased traffic congestion that a dedicated bus lane would have on a major thoroughfare?
Well, you know, the convergence pricing that New York is adopting is being looked at by cities small and large. And so if it pays, you know, if there's a cost associated with driving in downtown Manhattan, per se, and if I up that cost, I'm going to limit my traffic. It's like European models. European models don't go out and build autobahns with 6 and 7 lanes, because all that does is put more transportation onto those highways, so it doesn't really solve the problem. And what they do is they limit the transportation. They also make it costly to be able to use that public transportation. They also limit the amount of commercial traffic that's done on weekdays and weekends. There's a lot of studies from European models that we could use in the States to be able to adapt to the question that you're asking.
So COTA, the Columbus Transit Authority, is proposing the addition of new high-speed dedicated bus lines, but on those streets, it would impact the available lanes for cars and SUVs and other forms of vehicles. What you're saying is that New York City model could be adopted in Columbus, Ohio, meaning that if a car or a SUV or a pickup truck or something like that were to come into town, they'd have to pay a toll.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right.
And then your assertion is that based on the inconvenience and annoyance of having to pay a toll and then having to pay for parking, which is also at a premium in downtown Columbus, Ohio, that mm-hmm. would be enough to get people to reconsider their negative perceptions about public transportation.
Very well said.
Okay, well, you can hire me later. But seriously, that being said,
yeah.
The issue then becomes how many bus lines are necessary to accommodate a city that is growing in all directions and transcends the county line.
Well, again, I go back to the European model. If you've ever lived in a European city, which I have, you look at how, let's take, for example, Munich. I lived in Munich for a number of years, and you look at the bus lines and the commute lines. I never needed a car in that city. And that city is about the size, a little bit larger than Columbus. But it also has urban sprawl, suburban sprawl. But what you find is that you can get on a bus or whatever transportation, and it's linked from homes to where people work. That's the key. In other words, you might have to make maybe one or two transitions, but they're very fast and they're very efficient. So how the Germans have done it is they've laid out work and home in connection. They just haven't put it in independently. They just haven't followed existing routes. And that's what we don't – and I'm not necessarily condemning Columbus, but I'm saying as a way to look at how you lay out transportation, you've got to look at how you connect where people work versus where they live and make it convenient. And a lot of the commute and bus lines and things like that, you have to make a number of changes. They don't really go from point of where you work to where you – point of where you live to where you work as directly as people would like. And that's really what I would caution transportation planners to look at.
Yeah, the issue of having to transfer even once can be a deterrent for people to take public transportation. But one of the things that COTA is considering is making the buses free. If the buses were free, would you think that these folks would be more willing to at least give it a try once?
I don't think so. Again, it goes back to Marchetti's constant. It's about time. And my time is valuable. And if I'm on this, even though it's a free service, and I have to make two or three switches, I'm not there.
So we're going to have to wait for the teleporter. And when that comes, we'll be okay.
Well, I think that there's interim steps. In other words, there's a lot of smart people in transportation, COTA and other places that could benchmark off of high volume cities and what they have done to find solutions for this problem. Again, I look to Western Europe to be able to do that. And people have sent delegations to be able to do that. In fact, I think there was one that came from Ohio that went to some of the different cities in Germany when I was there. But I think that we can learn from people's solutions that have been implemented in other places. And I would heartily encourage that in that the newer technology, because the newer technology, again, back to Marchetti's concept, as the new technology arrives, it zips people around, that's going to mean the town's going to grow out. And I think that you lose the rural lifestyle that you have in the Columbus area.
Well, would you believe we're expected to triple in size by 2035?
Well, especially with New Albany going in and the northeast part of town and the semiconductor reshoring, I would find that easy to believe.
All right. If people want to read this study and learn more about this topic, is there a website they can go to?
Yeah, www.point2homes.com.
And that's point2homes.com.
Yeah, POINT2homes.com.
Okay, great. We want to thank Doug Ressler from Yardi Matrix for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
9 months ago, during a presidential debate, President Trump amplified false claims that Haitian immigrants in Springfield were eating cats and dogs. That led to turmoil, threats, and tension in the city. That controversy aside, the city of about 60,000 was experiencing rapid population growth. Last month, Governor DeWine went back to check in on Springfield to see how it's moving forward past that challenging time. He says the city is rising to meet the challenges.
This is a community that's on the move. This is a community that is moving forward.
Moving forward with the passage of time. 8 months after false claims about Haitian immigrants harming pets brought a crush of negative attention to the city, DeWine says the feeling in Springfield is much different.
The high level of kind of crisis feeling is gone. That is gone. Things are normal.
That's the message DeWine received Monday during a meeting with roughly 40 Springfield city and community leaders. This was a check-in after the state pumped in resources to help ease the strain of the controversy and rapid population growth at Springfield schools, in public safety, and in health care. A mobile clinic the state set up to help clear a backlog of patients is now gone.
The community's existing primary care resources are able to meet the needs.
State funding is also helping with projects to transform two old buildings downtown into retail space and about 150 apartments. But many businesses rely on Haitian employees, and uncertainty looms over the legal status of thousands of immigrants in the area. Governor DeWine says businesses are worried because temporary protected status for many of those immigrants expires on August 3rd unless the Trump administration renews it. Companies would not be able to employ them.
That is a big concern. It was a big concern that was expressed today.
And a big concern among the immigrant community. Jacob Payen is a U.S. citizen, a business owner, and a leader in the Haitian community.
A lot of people are living in fear because if you become now illegal based on your expired document, you're subject to deportation.
Now, Jacob Payen says some Haitians have left Springfield, but others are holding on to hope as the August 3rd deadline approaches. Governor DeWine addressed the temporary protected status of Haitian immigrants again this past week.
Well, I thought it was significant that, you know, the president made a week or so ago some comments in regard to people who are in the agriculture, that maybe they would pull that back. In other words, a realization of the fact that these are individuals who are essential to our economy. And I think that, you know, the more we see in that area, then I'm hopeful that maybe the president will look at manufacturing as well, because many of the Haitians are involved in manufacturing in Springfield.
Joining me now is Springfield Mayor Rob Rue. Mayor, thank you so much for coming here today to talk with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you again. Well, let's start there. What is the latest that you've heard in terms of the temporary protected status for the Haitians?
You know, we're hearing what everybody else is hearing. We're kind of bracing for the ever-changing thoughts of the government and what they're doing. So we're trying to just make sure we're keeping our citizens safe and controlling the narrative as much as we can, and making sure that if there's any concern being expressed, that it's in a safe way.
And I guess, how worried are you, or what's your thought process right now if it does expire on August 3rd, and what happens to employers there as well as the Haitians in the community?
I'm concerned definitely for the negative effect of a large amount of employees needing to be let go or released because of a federal policy, and how that'll affect the industry.
Is there anything the city or the state can do to help out in that situation, or is this all federal right now?
This is all federal. We'll comply with federal policy as we always have been in previous administrations, and we will in this administration as well.
And you heard Jacob Payen say in that piece that he knows that some Haitians have left Springfield. Are you noticing that?
You know, we're definitely seeing what I would say a visible decrease in some of our immigrant community. I don't know if they're staying inside or if they're or just, you know, trying to stay quiet, but there definitely has been a difference in the last several months.
I know that some of them were concerned about being deported and with the ICE raids that were starting. Has there been much of that going on in Springfield in terms of immigration services?
We're seeing a decrease in like, you know, there was a concern on folks coming in and receiving services from the county, and we've seen a decrease in that as well.
Okay. You know, on the flip side, the surge in population in a very short time put a strain on the city, the city's resources. How challenging was that, and where does it stand now?
So we're still seeing, you know, we've not seen the increase in the schools as far as the amount of enrollment in the schools. So that's kind of leveled off. And we're not seeing, honestly, we haven't seen the accidents that we were in the past. I don't know if that worked. That was one of the original concerns, is there was folks on our roads that didn't know how to drive. Yeah. And we've seen a decrease in those as well.
You know, I had a lot of people come up to me in those early days last September and the community, and they would just say, look, the Haitians are good people. They work hard. They just can't drive.
Yeah.
I had several that actually said that. And I know the governor and actually our Dom Tiberi helped out with that situation as well. Are you seeing a lot of people using those driving simulators to
You know, learn? The last I spoke with Director Wilson, I don't know if the use of those devices are getting as much use as they had hoped. But at the same time, I think the word has got out within the Haitian community. Don't drive illegally. Learn how to drive and be safer on the roads that you get to be a part of.
Can you take us back to that difficult time 9 months ago now, and, you know, just how much it impacted the city?
Well, I mean, you know, it was such a fast infusion of attention from on the national stage. We were reeling and trying to handle it the best we could. So compared to now, it's being in a hurricane or not in a hurricane, the way it felt. And I coined it a political vortex at the time. We were caught up in this political vortex and so many different opinions being shot at us and attention. And compared to now, that's not the case.
Yeah, Was it a frightening time too, or
absolutely.
Just a tense time because you had so many of the bomb threats and things that were coming
in? Oh, it was
in.
Absolutely. I mean, bomb threats to our school system, fear, you know, our kids were concerned, our families were concerned, and there was individual threats to, as you know, to the political leaders and some of the leaders in our community. It was a very scary time.
Now, I know you're a part-time mayor.
Yeah, very much.
And when you saw this starting to unfold, I mean, was there any way to possibly even prepare for it?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, I always try to approach this from our city as this is a human situation. You know, my concern was for the folks that were here. So I always try to take that approach when I was representing the city. And at the same time, our city was being mischaracterized on a national scale. And that's why I spoke out so much. Mm-hmm. That's why I took every interview, because our city was being said on a national level in a negative way, and it wasn't true.
So how different is it today compared to then, the temperature in the city?
I mean, I think it's moderate for sure. I mean, it's definitely leveled out compared to what it was. I think, you know, people want to know what's going to happen if ICE comes into our community. We're not making policy based on speculation. We're definitely watching the same news that everybody else is, and we're trying to prepare in such a way that we can be, very calm in the approach.
What things are you focused on right now in terms of serving those in your community, the residents of Springfield and the surrounding area?
Well, I mean, we've still had a good forward momentum in our community even through the last several months. So we have seen a lot of growth, and we've seen a lot of housing growth in our community, and those things are still happening.
New housing?
New housing, new residential development downtown in our community as well as on the outskirts of our community.
I mentioned those two buildings that are basically on either side of City Hall, right downtown. Buildings that have been there a long time but are starting to get a new life.
Yeah.
How important are those projects to kind of, I don't want to say revitalizing downtown, but to you know, pumping up that area?
Very much revitalizing downtown. I mean, you're looking at 160 market rate apartments in downtown Springfield, and they're nice quality apartments. So we're excited about that.
Other projects like that going
on? Yeah, I mean, there's 1,200 homes being built on the east side of Springfield. It's a major development. So we're definitely, things are still happening, and that did not slow down. We're grateful for that. And I think in large part, that's how the leaders in Springfield responded to this, is that didn't slow that growth.
What would you say right now, then, is the biggest challenge that the city is facing?
Well, I mean, just like any other community, legacy community, we need still need economic growth. We still need to focus on the, you know, there's been gun violence in our community, like in every other community, and we're focused on that and trying to curb that as well and meet with community leaders and stakeholders.
I understand the numbers are up this year as far as gun or gun violence goes compared to past years, but it was never like a high number. How concerned are you about it?
I know this is, I don't mean this trite, but one is a high number, and anybody would say that, but I mean that, and it's painful to see, particularly youth gun violence, so we're trying to meet with folks to handle that as best as possible.
The Springfield News Sun reported that a community violence prevention grant for the city was abruptly canceled by the federal government soon after approving budget revisions. I think it was $1.25 million that would have gone for gun violence prevention efforts. How frustrating is that not to have that money come in for you?
Well, it's incredibly frustrating. There's funds being allotted to handle something that's a problem, and now it's not there. That's frustrating, especially for a community like Springfield, Ohio.
What do you have to say about the way your, you know, mid-sized city, you know, responded in this crisis time and has continued to respond with your staff, employees, residents?
I'm very proud of Springfield. I'm very proud of the leaders. I mean, we've come together to solve problems. When there's a crisis, we come together, and that is the beauty and the strength of Springfield, Ohio.
Was the influx of the Haitians, the estimates are 12 to 15,000 came in a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. Was that kind of like a surprise that many people came and how to deal with it? Because I understand that some of it was word of mouth in the community, and that drew them in.
Yeah, I mean, it was an absolute surprise to me that the numbers were so high. I mean, you definitely could see there was different members of our community coming in, but that number was really high to me, and I was surprised when we started to learn that. And that's wanting to know, how did we get to that point without knowing that this many folks were coming to our community, that we are increasing by 10 to 20% of our population in such a short time? Who knew that, and why weren't we informed of that? That was a concern at the time.
Is the 58,900 number for the population like accurate now, or is it above
that? That's
the
number we
had
prior to the influx.
So you're looking at like 72,000 or so now?
I mean, we don't have a census, but yeah.
Wow. So what's your focus now, I guess, in the next, what is it, about 5 or 6 weeks heading up to that August 3rd TPS deadline?
I mean, it sounds, it's watch and wait, and it's watch and see. You know, we had a rumor that was spread that was not true last week, that the ICE agents were in town. It was not true. But we're concerned about also the social media, you know, explosion of that. We don't want that to happen as well. So we try to get the truth out there as much as possible, as quickly as possible.
Part of the reason you're here.
That's exactly why I'm here.
Have you said that early on, you took every interview.
Yeah.
Did you feel that it was really important for you as the mayor to be the lead voice out there, you know, debunking things, but also letting people know what
was
going on?
It's funny you say that. I actually was not ready to do these interviews, and I had some community leaders come around me and say, we need to hear from you. And this was right before the bomb threats happened, and then the bomb threats happened, and then our city was being mischaracterized. And I just took every interview that was, you know, most interviews, some interviews were coming from around the world, and I didn't do that. They wanted to talk about what wasn't true. But I wanted to speak directly to what was being said at our city. So I took a lot of every local and national interview I could take.
Another one of those things you didn't expect.
Did not. So it was trial mayor by fire.
Yeah. Well, Mayor Rue, I do appreciate you driving here today to appear on the show and talking about the situation there. Best wishes to you as the city continues to grow and evolve.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
The Ohio House and Senate passed the state's $60 billion two-year operating budget. It comes in at more than 6,000 pages. It lays out the future income tax you will pay, plus funding for public schools and much more. Public school funding has been one of the most talked about topics of this budget. 10TV's Carly Dion looks at how funding Ohio schools is being addressed.
Advocates for public education disappointed in what they're calling cuts to funding for public schools. Democrats say it falls short of the Fair School Funding Plan.
What we passed today is not the full Fair School Funding Formula.
State Senator Nikki Antonio says this is yet another example of broken promises in the budget, and there were no negotiations across the aisle when it came to many of the decisions that were made. She says the Republican majority claimed the current funding plan for school districts wasn't sustainable.
But then they found $600 million for a sports franchise. I mean, that shows me that it's just misplaced priorities.
Antonio is referring to the $600 million allocated to build a new football stadium for the Cleveland Browns. But many Republicans argue they're actually increasing funding to public education in this budget.
We just raised spending in public schools over $600 million.
Look, when you look at the amount of money we put into public schools over the last three budgets, $4.5 billion of increases over that course of that time frame.
State Senator Rob McCauley says he believes people are upset about the property tax provisions included in the budget. He claims right now, 70% of all Ohioans' property taxes go towards their school district.
And when we see school districts carrying over, in some cases, 70, 80, 90%, sometimes well over 100% of their annual expenditures year to year, it stands to be reason that there should be an explanation for why they need to carry over that much money while they're charging very high property taxes.
But education advocates beg to differ.
Everybody's upset about property taxes going up. This is going to make property taxes go up even more. If the state doesn't give us that money, the only recourse we have is to go to voters for property tax.
Senator McCauley says he doesn't believe the cuts to public education are as dire as some districts claim it to be.
I don't believe the hyperbole out there that somehow education is going to not be funded adequately.
I'm Shanola Hampton. Every day, millions of people face hunger. Today, I will share with you some of their experiences. I'm stuck between paying for medications or paying for food. John from Maine. After paying my bills, I can buy groceries. It's sad to say, food comes last. Alice from Oregon. I thought pantries were for less fortunate people, but anybody could be less fortunate in a day or even a second. Claire from Virginia. The Feeding America Network of Food Banks helps provide over 6 billion meals to people in need each year. No one should have to worry where their next meal will come from. Together, we can end hunger. Learn more at feedingamerica.org.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Vice President J.D. Vance returned to his home state on Tuesday for a big state GOP event. He spoke to about 1,000 Republican supporters at the Ohio Republican Party dinner at the Convention Center in Lima. We went there to hear what the vice president had to say about the conflict between Israel and Iran, the ceasefire, and America's role in it. Vance started his speech by joking that he was in Lima because there was nothing big going on in the world and it was a boring day at the White House. He then talked seriously about America's actions against Iran.
I gotta say, it feels like a great homecoming to be here in Lima today.
The Middletown, Ohio native gave the keynote address to a sold-out crowd at the Ohio Republican Party dinner. He talked about President Trump's decision-making leading up to the U.S. military bombings of 3 Iranian nuclear facilities.
He said it consistently through his second term, is that he does not want Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
He said the president negotiated with Iran for 60 days before ordering the airstrikes.
When the president realized that there was not going to be a peaceful settlement to that problem, he sent B-2 bombers and dropped 12 30,000-pound bombs on the worst facility and destroyed that program.
Vance laid out what he calls the Trump doctrine for avoiding another drawn-out conflict in the Middle East. Define the American interest, negotiate aggressively to achieve that interest, and use overwhelming force if necessary.
Not only did we destroy the Iranian nuclear program, we did it with 0 American casualties.
Ohio Republican Party Chairman Alex Triantafilou.
What do you think of the role that the vice president has played in all
all of this as it's played out?
Well, I think the American people know that in addition to being the Vice President of the United States, he's also a critical advisor, supporter, close confidant of the President of the United States.
Vice President Vance spoke for about 34 minutes. He also touched on illegal immigration and border security and the impact of the Trump tariffs. He also thanked all the supporters in the room for their hard work, saying he thinks Ohio will stay Republican red for a very long time. Ohio Republican Senator Bernie Moreno says he wants President Trump to receive the Nobel Peace Prize for his actions in Iran.
If it's viewed from the lens of whether you like President Trump or don't like President Trump, take that lens out and just give the man credit for the amazing accomplishment he did, and that's exactly what the Nobel Peace Prize was intended to do.
Senator Moreno introduced a resolution in the U.S. Senate to formally nominate the president for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.